Welcome to the podcast, Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, your host, and our focus is on mastering communication as an essential leadership skill so that you can command the room, connect with the audience, and close the deal in any context. After over 200 episodes, we are a top 1% podcast globally, thanks to you. So if you love listening to these conversations as much as I love sharing them with you, please take 30 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, your favorite platform, or otherwise just go to the website ratethispodcast.com/influence and follow their super simple directions. Now, on with the show. This today is evidence that when you do good things, the universe rewards you. My guest this week is somebody that I met when facing one of my toughest audiences ever, middle school students. Yes, we were both volunteering at our local middle school's career day. We got paired together, which was just a lucky happenstance for me. And I hope he believes so as well. I guess if he wouldn't, he probably wouldn't have agreed to then be on my show. But it is now my very great pleasure to introduce to everybody my guest, Jeff Orlando, the Chief Learning Officer for Bristol-Myers Squibb. Jeff has worked in leadership, learning, and talent in companies over the course of more than 20 years, leading organizations like Deloitte and Medtronic, as well as BMS, of course. He's also presented on these topics with collaborators ranging from leading academics on one end to NFL coaches on the other. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hey, Laura, thank you for having me. And I agree with you. I actually presented to our BMS executive committee the day after our middle school crowd. And I was more nervous for our middle schoolers than our leaders. Absolutely.
They are by far one of the toughest groups to get through. If you don't come with like a gaming controller attached to you, it's almost like, well, why are you here? You're of no interest to me. So it was a unique experience to say the least. But tell us another fun fact about you, aside from, of course, your love for communicating to middle school students.
It's not my fun fact, but a fun fact that's in our family. So my grandfather, who was in advertising and marketing his entire career, actually invented the cereal Golden Grahams.
I love Golden Grahams.
A crowd favorite.
Yes, those are delicious. I haven't had them in a million years, but those were a real favorite for a long time. So this is your grandfather?
This is my grandfather on my mother's side, and he was an early marketer, early TV commercial producer, really cool guy.
So did you just always, always, always have a box of Golden Grahams in your cabinet in the kitchen at home growing up?
Still do. So we buy family size container. Absolutely.
Good. That's great loyalty. Great loyalty. And we should have brought that in to give out to the middle schoolers. Maybe that would have helped them actually sit up and pay attention. Thought for next time. So tell us a little bit about Bristol-Myers Squibb or BMS. What's your 30-second elevator pitch?
Sure. Bristol-Myers Squibb is a pharmaceutical company with an over 100-year history. We focus on solving for some of the most rare or hard-to-treat diseases. And just a fabulous portfolio of hematology, oncology, cardiovascular, and growing into neuroscience, the conditions that we treat. Fabulous employer, fabulous history.
It sounds like it. I mean, any company that can last over 100 years, that's incredible. And most can't make it to the decade. Now, what's the most important leadership communication lesson that you've had to learn on that trajectory? Not that it's been 100 years, but nevertheless.
Not quite. It does feel like it's some days, but not quite.
Sure.
It brings me back to an experience I had. This probably dates back 15 or so years ago, where with another organization, we did a leadership offsite. And we were down at one of the hotels in Palm Beach, Florida, beautiful hotel right on the beach. One of the conference rooms was literally facing the ocean. So we had these waves breaking against the glass, leaving a salt residue on the glass over the course of this meeting.
Wow.
So I was trying to maintain attention of a number of senior leaders in this room while they're wistfully looking out at a beautiful sparkling sea, right? So first communication challenge there. But I was trying to explain a relatively complex concept to this group of senior leaders, all VP or above leaders. And I was up in front of the room for 10 to 15 minutes explaining this concept, not resonating, taking a different angle of attack, not resonating, and just starting to flounder a bit, to use the ocean reference,
sure,
in front of this group of senior leaders. And my boss at the time, who to his credit, let me give this a real go in front of this group, came up and said, Jeff, let me just take a moment and try and reset the group's expectation. He brought out a flip chart, one of those sticky flip charts, placed it on the wall, put on the flip chart, 1, 2, 3, went off and very clearly explained in 3 bumper stickers the concepts I was struggling to explain in more complex and maybe more full, but more complex terms. Mm. And after about 2 minutes of his explanation, 1, 2, 3 bumper stickers, They nodded their head, they agreed, and we moved on. So I learned in that moment, with senior leaders especially, the importance of simplifying, the rule of three, and not trying to tell everything, but tell what's most important.
I want to ask you to home in on that notion of simplifying, because somebody might misunderstand that as being like, you have to dumb it down, or you have to leave out all the important stuff. What advice can you give somebody who's going, yeah, but how do I take away all the other stuff? And just what is the bumper sticker that they want to know? What are the 10 words or 50 words? How do you make that decision?
A lot of times with leaders, we convey what's important to us, the fullness of something that matters and resonates to our world, given the specialty we have, right? What worked in this case was conveying what was important for them to hear only. And I find using the why, what, and how to be a good way to explain. Why are we doing it? What will we be doing or accomplishing? And how will it get done? And that simple 1, 2, 3 lets you have a more clear, concise message.
I appreciate the way you just distilled that, because I think this is something, and I literally just gave a couple of trainings over the last 2 days on this, and it's such a point of stress and of fear for people who are presenting up to senior leaders. It's like, I know I got to get it done something, but how do I know what they want? And that's such a great heuristic, the 1, 2, 3 of the why, what, how. Tell us one more time, the why, the what, the how, they stand for what?
Why are we doing this thing? Mm-hmm. What will we accomplish or result? And then how will we get it done?
Yes.
1, 2, 3, nice and easy.
And it's interesting that it's why, what, and how, as I think many people have watched maybe Simon Sinek's TED Talk with the golden circle and all that kind of stuff. And sure, he does the why, how, what, as opposed to why, what, how. But it all depends on how you're framing it and what is not so much features as in Simon's TED Talk. Yours is what is the result, which is more connected to the why that way. So I want to make sure people aren't confusing those things, but that's great. So I hope everybody who's driving right now is pulling over and not trying to thumb note take while driving on your notes app, because that was definitely a golden nugget right there.
And Laura, to your point on how do you know what senior leaders want to hear about?
Yes.
You ask them.
Mm.
One other quick aside, I presented to a senior leadership group recently. I had my prepared slides. As I came in, the group said to me, "We would much rather have a conversation about your topic than roll through all your slides."
Mm.
I was not fully prepared for that statement, right? But what I did in the beginning is I said, okay, let's make a list of your top 10 questions on this topic, and then we will go and figure out the answers. So I just collected those 10 topics, and then we had a conversation and fished through those slides a bit over the course of the 45 minutes. But it was a very engaged group, a very good conversation, because I answered what they were curious about versus what I wanted to share. So turning that mirror around on your listener is usually good too.
So you would tell people that it's okay if I have received the instructions, okay, Laura, go and prepare to present to the whatever leadership team on this topic. I can turn around and ask either my point person or potentially poll all of the attendees for that, depending on who they are, how much access I have, all that kind of thing, and say, what do you want to know most? Or what would be the question that I would ask them?
Absolutely. And if you're even more of a risk taker, present an executive summary of your topic, stop talking, and ask what questions they're most curious about live in the room. That's one way to get a much more engaged connection with time-starved leaders, for sure.
And then you just would have 75 slides worth of appendix that you should be able to scroll right through quickly to find whatever it is that they're most interested in. Is that basically it?
That's right. And the challenge with this model is you really need to know your stuff.
Yes. And that's, I think, is the scary part. It's like, if I just make it all Q&A, then I'm as unprepared as is technically possible for, I mean, I have to know everything, but I don't have control. Not that I'm not prepared, but I'm not in control.
That's right.
Of the content that gets discussed if I open it up. Mm-hmm. So What's your advice to people who are like, I would need 75 years to prepare enough to be truly confident to be able to do that well? How do I relinquish that control without screwing myself in the process?
I think leaders are more forgiving of, let me go find that out for you, than we believe they will be.
Mm.
Right?
Okay.
So I think that's an okay thing for a number of senior leaders to tolerate. But I would not have been bold enough to use that method if I weren't deep in my subject matter, for sure.
So you need to be able to give an awful lot of information of other things. And I don't mean fire hose drown them in other details to tap dance when you don't have the answer. But of course, you need to be able to answer enough of the other questions and show enough relevant subject matter expertise to be able to here and there, if necessary, say the, let me find that out for you.
And I've definitely learned the lesson on not trying to answer a question that I don't know the answer to. Fumbling, attempting, nope, just don't try and come back later.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice, isn't it? It's kind of the rock and the hard place. Either admit that I don't know or prove that I don't know.
That's right. I think the admission sounds better.
It's certainly more concise, right? Just dragging it out with more and more words and digging yourself in is probably not the way to go. So to kind of unapologetically, confidently just state, I don't have that answer yet, or I will get it, and then move on quickly and segue into the next topic, you know, confirm that you can get it a certain time, but that make your commitment, uphold the commitment, and then move on. Am I understanding that right?
I think so. And one could even use the strategy of saying that at the beginning. If I don't know the answers, I'll get back to you tomorrow.
Interesting. Okay, so preface that. You could almost control the narrative of sorts. Right. And it's not to say to them, look, I probably won't be able to answer any of your questions. I don't belong here. I'm not a subject matter expert. But if you let them know, here's the structure of today's meeting. I'm going to give you the executive summary. And then I'm going to ask you what you'd like to focus on most. I will do my best to answer as many of those questions as I can. But if there's one that I can't for whatever reason, I will get back to you as soon as possible. Does that work for everyone?
Well said.
Okay. And leaders would not look at you like, you're kidding me, right? You don't have a totally ready presentation. You're just going to wing it on Q&A. That's an unlikely response from them.
I think you're owning the room. You're owning the room. And most senior leaders sit through entire days of very curated, perfect presentations with rehearsed presenters. Which creates for them, and they know this, right? It creates a bit of a rose-colored view of reality or a curated view of reality.
Yeah.
And senior leaders crave, I know I do, more of a real truth, real full story, which helps them make better decisions.
And that is
presenting in a bit more of a Q&A format gets closer to that.
I would also venture that when you are sitting in back-to-back meetings of curated presentations, after a while, your eyes glaze over just getting talked at by presenters for however long with varying degrees of interestingness. I'm going to coin a phrase there. Whereas when you get to participate in more of the conversations, it's no different when somebody's presenting down to you, across to you, whatever else it is. It's hard to sit there and just listen. When you get to participate more actively, you're engaged, and then you can, it's just a better experience overall 9 times out of 10. Fair?
Fair.
Okay, so everybody out there, are you hearing this? Are you trembling in your boots, or do you feel more relieved that you can actually frame and pose it as a Q&A ahead of time? But again, Jeff gave lots of great suggestions as far as ways to ask for their top 10 questions ahead of time and then guide the conversation accordingly. Send the executive summary ahead of time and see which of those elements they might want to home in on more specifically, dive a little bit deeper. There are ways to get ahead of it. So you still control the narrative. So you still control the direction, but you figured out what the things are that the executives or the leaders that you're presenting to are most interested in. So you're going to make it the most valuable use of their time and yours. And you're not going to hear, so wait, where are you going with this? You know what? Let's just skip ahead to the, you know, slide 72. We're not interested in the first 50 something that you've put together. I think I'd much rather go that direction. On that, let's move on to our next topic, but that was awesome. So thank you for going deep with us on that. Jeff, tell me about an opportunity that you missed because you held back. We're talking here about all these things where you should be proactive and take these risks and reach out and get the questions ahead of time. Tell me about something when you didn't take that proactive step. What happened?
Laura, I know a lot of your leaders are in innovation roles here. Your listeners are in innovation roles where they're trying to push either an innovation agenda inside of a company or sell a product that's maybe a new way of doing things, maybe a new technology. And I was in a role where I was an innovation project leader. This was inside of a large organization. And I was selling something all new, internally selling something all new to the company. And I was of the mind that if I could go out and get 50, 60, 70, 80 leaders in the company who really would support this work. That would give a wind at my back as the project leader and propel that work forward. So I was on a bit of a door-to-door sales process inside of this company, getting leaders to support it. I had maybe 10, 12, 15 leaders who were psyched up and enthused about supporting this innovation project. But I didn't have the critical mass I thought I needed, 50, 60, 70. And because I didn't have that critical mass, I kept knocking on doors until I could get closer to that target number. The problem was the energy level of those 10 or 12 leaders who were influential began to dissipate over time. Mm. The winds of change in the company moved around over time. Priorities shift in organizations, and a lot has to do with timing.
Sure.
So I missed a window in driving that work forward and getting a lot of support because I was holding out for a level of support that really wasn't critical to drive the work. And we eventually got that work back on track, but it took me 6 months of work and renegotiation versus just moving when I had a tipping point of support versus a full boat of support.
Full quorum. Mm-hmm. So if I'm hearing the story correctly, that what I'm taking away is even if there are a lot of people involved, I don't need to have everybody's buy-in first before starting to move. As long as I have that critical mass, perhaps the right handful of strong leaders who are going to be your early adopters from sort of the tech standpoints, where they'll get on board and they'll evangelize for you. They'll help to galvanize others, and just delegating some of that responsibility to them and just moving ahead first.
That's right. And it would have required me to stick my neck out even more as a leader to move forward with a smaller number of peers.
Interesting.
And it takes a little bit to learn, some bravery and courage to do that.
And you feel like it would have worked had you gone forward with that dozen leaders in your corner first, even if you didn't have the other 50 necessarily.
That's right. The leaders who were among that early dozen, they were frustrated that they had given support for this. They had used some of their social capital to support it, but we weren't moving it as forward as quickly as they would have preferred.
What advice would you give to somebody who's at that precipice? They do need to make the decision. How many people worth of support is enough to move forward? Because you are sticking your neck out. I mean, everything is your name, your neck, your brand, all that kind of stuff. At what point do you go, well, gee, you only had 10 people, but you needed 50. What were you thinking? Versus you had 10. The other 50 would come. You just needed to take the bull by the horns and go. How do you not feel like you're just flipping a coin?
I think it's the phone a friend model with all of us know in our organizations, masters of influence. And if you can find a master of influence, call them up, buy them coffee, tell them your situation, tell them what support you have, and get a sanity check from them, that will give you the clue you need on whether to move ahead or wait.
Interesting, the sanity check. So you use them as a sounding board, find the right person and say, am I nuts for doing this? Or can we make this work? Can we pull off the miracle of sorts?
And of course, in asking for their advice, you're also recruiting them to join your team.
Yes, doing pitch coaching and whatnot with a variety of different incubators and tech startups and things. One of the most interesting pieces of advice that I heard coming from one of the venture capitalists involved was, if you want money, ask for advice. If you want advice, ask for money. And I thought that was just a really interesting philosophy that, you know, going right up to somebody and saying, hey, give me the money for this. They'll go, well, okay, let's hold off, but let me give you some advice. Whereas if you get somebody, go right in and say, I need your input, your insight, your expertise, help me make this decision. Well, they help you make the decision, but then they're kind of emotionally invested. They want you to succeed. They want to see that their advice has been valuable. So they might be more willing to give you some sort of capital, whether it's actual financial or social or political or whatever else. So that was kind of a fun way to look at it. And it seems like your experience speaks to that as well.
Yeah, we all want to see our influence come to life in the world.
Yes.
We can oftentimes provide an avenue for that if we can invite others into good work.
Right.
That's right.
Now, what about a time when you did decide to take a big risk? What was at stake and how did you communicate that decision to your key stakeholders?
It's interesting. In sequence in my career, this occurred after the story I just told you. So maybe I learned something, right? Wouldn't that be nice
Lovely.
If that were true?
From the chief learning officer.
Right. That is a fair point. That's a fair point. In this story, leading a relatively large team that was a global team, serving a very large business, And we saw an opportunity to reduce cost, increase efficiency by offshoring and outsourcing a significant piece of work. And this was a bit before the current day where companies are now more comfortable working globally and also with some of the more outsourced offshore models. This was a little earlier in some of those progressions for large businesses. And I saw the opportunity to do this. I had met the team, I had made the trip, and felt comfortable with this change that we could deliver after probably about a year or so of bumps. We could deliver well for this business unit and free up money for other things. So in this case, I was able to be the decision maker and did make the decision to move to outsource and offshore a significant piece of work. And what worked out well here was I was able to set expectations with our leaders that we would anticipate the following five issues, that we would expect this to take 1 to 2 years to settle down and to get back to previous service levels. And when I was making the call, I asked them if they would support seeing those issues play through over time and if they would support 12 to 24 months of disruption as we brought this online. And the benefit of the change was good enough, strong enough that they could get behind that. So then fast forward, we make the decision, we onboard the team. A bunch of those issues start to pop up. They were predicted, we had discussed them. And when the email would come in, that would kind of get your heart racing a little bit. We were able to lean back on, we understand, we saw this coming, here's the mitigation, hang tight. So it was successful and turned into a great result, but it was made easier because we gave our business leaders confidence due to the prediction and the execution against those issues.
It's interesting how when you're looking in the future and you're saying, okay, we're looking at this particular road ahead, here's where there's going to be some potholes, here's where there's some bumps in the road. But once we get past that and we will weather that storm, here's where the sun is bright and we're going to get to that and the road is smooth moving ahead. And it's easier to get that buy-in when people's emotions are not invested. They're not in the middle of the airplane turbulence or the potholes in the road. So they can be more objective in saying, okay, a little bit of bumps expected. We'll wait it out. Looking forward to something. Because then when you're in the middle of that turbulence of those bumps, then it's the emotions that are kicking in. Then the adrenaline is in the, oh my gosh, what are we supposed to do about this? How long is this going to last? You forget why you voluntarily took this path in the first place. So to be able then to go back and say, remember we had this conversation when everyone was calm, when everything made sense, and this is exactly what we predicted. This is what we brought within reason, of course, exact may not be the right word, but this is effectively what we had anticipated. So we are on course for that brighter future that's just around the corner.
Yep.
And how did they receive that?
I mean, range from, oh, right. That's right. I remember that conversation to having to do some reminders and a little bit of history around that. But in general, it worked well. It worked well. And I use the same strategy with my kids. Hey, it's going to be a road trip. This is 6 hours. I know we're stopping twice, not five times. Here's what to expect. Dinner when we get there, right?
Yes.
A lot of managing people.
Yes.
Is making sure expectations are lined up.
Isn't it funny how the same principles apply to family as well as to work, no matter how big or small the company? The are we there yet? Oh my gosh, this is taking so long. But Dad, I know I promised this, but I didn't think it would, all that kind of stuff. In case you're wondering, I have no ability to relate to what you're talking about on that front.
Right.
Not with family.
You had a little empathy there. I heard the empathy. I
heard it. Yes. Complete and total. Yes, we're actually getting ready for one of those weekends coming up. So that'll be batting down the hatches for the nice long car ride. Jeff, this is a great opportunity, I think, to challenge our listeners. So it's time for the Listener 24-Hour Influence Challenge. How would you like to challenge our listeners to take one step that they can complete within 24 hours to have more influence?
I find a good influence tool is give your stakeholder or your customer something they don't know that is about their business or about them.
Okay.
As in, here's a piece of data about your business unit you might find interesting. Here's an external piece of insight as compared to our own internal data that's different. Usually if it's quantitative, it really works well because it shows you're listening, it shows you're caring about them as a person and their business. That is a nice influence strategy that lets them ask the next question, tell me more about that. Help me understand even more how you got that information or understand it. So that quantitative nugget that's relevant to their life.
Interesting. Okay. So do a little bit of proactive research into their division, their challenge, their company, their product of interest or something, and just offer them a little piece of trivia, not necessarily trivia, but some sort of insight that they might not have realized that could be of use to them.
I'm in the HR world, right? If I were to call up one of our business unit leaders and say, hey, did you know you have the best retention of anybody here at BMS? They're curious. Why? How long has that happened for? What's working well, right? Or conversely, hey, I'm watching out for you. You have the worst retention here. Thanks for letting me know. Tell me more about what we could do to help turn that trend around. Those would be conversations, again, back to inviting questions.
Yeah.
That open up further dialogue.
And I would imagine that the latter example would be one that you'd have to approach carefully, of course, to be giving somebody some not so happy news and say, hey, I just want you to know I'm aware of this and you're having this challenge, so that they are open to more questions as opposed to getting massively defensive or shutting down or turning on the panic button in one way, shape, or form.
That's right. If you can call up in an informal way as a partner who's there to help, that's well received, which is different from seeing a upsetting piece of data in a business review, right? So finding the setting that lets you position yourself as someone on their side that's trying to help.
Yes. All right, everybody, you know what to do. Now, Jeff, what's a communication skill you weren't born with and had to learn?
I took this question pretty literally when I first saw it. I took foreign languages through high school and college. I took French. I was a French major in college, in addition to a psychology major. And I did it just because of the love of the language. I found it to be a beautiful language and, you know, linguistics, just always interesting and how languages change over time. So anyway, I was a French major and it's a skill I had to learn. And when you're studying and learning a language, a lot of times you are searching for the right word.
Yes.
Right. In English, I know most of the specific precise words. In French, I have to find my way around vocabulary to explain a specific object as an example. And that turned me into thinking about the intentionality that's needed and the choicefulness, the choosiness you need to have around picking the right words. And back in my native tongue, I have become over the years much more of a careful speaker.
Interesting.
More of someone who thinks through what I'm saying, choosing the right words, because words have so much depth of meaning. So being careful and choosy about the right words is something I've kind of come around to through studying a foreign language.
And I think most people have studied, whether it was 2 years of Spanish in high school or gone much more in depth of foreign language study, there is something really humbling about that experience, no matter what level of fluency you've attained, to sit there and think, to realize it'd be so much easier to say this in my native language. So let me figure out how to get the point across as clearly and concisely and carefully as possible, to then take that backwards and reapply it to the native language, where we tend to take it for granted that we have so much facility with the language that we're not efficient in what we say. And we do tend to go all around a topic just because we can, rather than because we need to, as opposed to what you're describing, which the technical term, and this is where I'll go geek out as a linguist, but it's called circumlocution, where you have to sort of talk around a word or around a topic to be able to, to get to it. And it is something that we absolutely need to do. You know, it's funny, I went last year to Italy with my older son, who's had a beginning level of fluency, proficiency in Italian, and he was struggling at one point. And I just said to him, don't you wish you could take a post-it note, stick it on your forehead, and write, in my language, I'm smart? And he just looked at me and went, yes, oh my gosh. I thought, yeah, well, me too, in whichever of the languages that I'm trying to speak in. But it is a humbling experience for sure.
Absolutely. I have so much respect for people, especially folks who move to a new country or a new location and have to learn a new language. It's an incredible feat to do that, and kind of hard too.
Sure. And when you think about how it's one thing to have to live in a community and do daily interactions, socially speaking, in a second language, it's another to have to work and have your livelihood depend on it. I mean, for everybody out there who's working in your native language and still knows how hard it is to communicate your everything effectively, imagine how hard it must be to reach that level of fluency or above in a second or third language. So to anybody out there who is a native speaker of English and working with somebody else who is not, just acknowledge them and say, you know, I never really thought about how amazing your English actually is and how much extra brain work you must be going through every day just to have to do this another layer above what I have to do. I never really thought about it. And just give them credit. I can't imagine anybody not saying thank you for that acknowledgement.
Agreed. That would be an uplift for anybody. Absolutely.
I think they often feel very, and clients that I've had who are non-native English speakers working with them, there is that frustrating of just never feeling like you're good enough, like you sound smart enough, or that you're as good as you could have been if you were doing it in a different language. So I don't think it would be putting anybody off or embarrassing anybody to give them that credit. Just the acknowledgement of how good they really are would be a massive ego boost for an awful lot of people out there.
Agreed.
So I'm giving everybody else a second 24-hour influence challenge. Sure, or do Jeff's first in the 24 hours and then do mine afterwards. But
the 48-hour challenge.
The 48-hour double layer. All right. So finally, Jeff, finish this sentence for me. I wish I was better at explaining what to whom.
I wish I was better at explaining deep data, deep stats, deep quant to senior leaders. And I'm decent at it, maybe even pretty good at it. But I think it's a killer app. Those folks who can take complex data and weave a story, even with visuals.
Yeah.
Awesome, awesome, awesome skill.
And it's interesting that you are not coming from the quant side of things. When people think about quant and numbers verticals, they're often thinking finance or IT. And how do you explain that kind of tech to people more in your space, in HR and in, right, you know, sales or ops or something else? But whatever our space is in human resources, there's plenty of stats, there's plenty of finance, there's plenty of quant, plenty of numbers that have to be discussed. And you, as chief learning, you are a CXO, you are a chief officer of the company, and you still have to present up higher yet to the CEO, to the board of directors, to whoever else, and need to take your stats and distill them in a way that is digestible and meaningful for others who aren't immersed in those numbers every day. Am I hearing that correctly?
That's right. That's fair. It's how do you use those numbers to tell your story in a compelling way that they'll care about? And it takes effort to do that, for sure.
And I think the word that you used there that I want to really reinforce again is story. It's not just how do you share the numbers or report the numbers. There is a story behind them. So when you say tell the story of those numbers, what might that look like in your space?
I mean, for me, I'm looking after how we build our leaders, how we learn the key skills we need to have to advance our company. So a lot of my story is the leadership attributes that we've gained and how those have impacted our business performance, or the skills we project we'll need more of in our company in 2030 and how we're tracking towards having those prevalent in our workforce. Those are the kinds of numbers typically that I'm talking through, and doing that in a compelling way.
And the kinds of stories that you might share, are they more case studies? Are they examples of single individuals? Are they future projections of what it might look like? And imagine this.
I tend to use some personas and individual stories as color commentary, right? That's not enough, but it can be nice to round out. Here's an example, and here's Laura's example of how that has worked out for Laura. But more so, I try to use a wider time horizon, meaning let's look back at our artificial intelligence skill set at BMS 3 years ago. Let's look at it today. And then let's look at it 3 years forward. And what's our projection look like based on what we're doing or not doing? And those tend to kind of lay some groundwork. But if I were even stronger, I'd have a hero and a villain in my stories, and I'm growing towards it.
We'll have to have you back when you've got some of those heroes and villains, and you'll take us on the next epic saga for that.
Heroes only.
Heroes only. I love it. That's great. Jeff, I'm so sorry that our time is coming to an end, because I love how deeply we're digging into some of these topics. I'm going to go back and take notes on it myself for future conversations in other spaces. So how can people learn more about you and BMS?
We would love to hear from you from a BMS perspective. Check out our website. Also, our ESG report is a great summary of how we're impacting the world through our work. So we'd invite you to look at that on our website. And of course, I'm on LinkedIn. I would love to connect with your listeners, Laura.
And the website is?
BMS.com.
Nice and easy. And of course, we'll put that in the show notes for everybody else. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so glad we went to middle school together.
That's right. We did it. We survived it. Thank you, Laura.
My pleasure. And to everybody else out there, thank you as always for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And again, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your platform of choice so we can help even more people to increase their confidence, presence, and influence. And when in doubt, go to ratethispodcast.com/influence and follow their instructions for how to rate and review the show. And finally, if you want to download my free guide to equipment recommendations for your virtual influence, including my picks for microphones, lights, and more, go to speakingtoinfluence.com. I'm Dr. Laura Sokola, and you're listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite.
Thanks for listening to Speaking to Influence, Communication Secrets of the C-Suite, the show for leaders who want to speak with impact. The hosts, producers, owners, and media distributors of the show make no guarantees that the strategies and information discussed will result in profit or other success and may result in losses. The opinions and statements of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the owners, staff, managers, broadcasters, or sponsors of the show. No medical or psychological therapy or personal or professional wellness or relationship advice is offered in the show. You are advised to seek counsel on matters related to your health, family, relationships, job, or other business and legal matters from licensed advisors in those areas prior to making any changes in business or lifestyle. No information provided may be suitable in your situation. As always, take responsibility for the decisions and actions you take, including the reactions they may make in your work, family, health, and life.